Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Today we're honored again to have our friend Steve Peskin. He's the very model of engaged Buddhism. And we're doing good.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thanks very much, Jim. Thank you for inviting me back. It's good to be back here and seeing many familiar faces and many new ones. Hello to the new ones and to the old ones, quote unquote. And I'm very glad to be here today. I was here a couple of weeks ago for the first time in a long time, and it felt like coming home in a certain way to a group that's been part of my life for a long time, 22 years in some form or another. So it's nice to be here on Daddy's Day and Father's Day. And this morning I am going to go personal and talk about some of the things and issues I have been practicing with lately, and invite the group and larger Sangha to participate and share in this and consideration, because this is a very live consideration for me right now. And it's not abstract, as it has been to some extent in the past, more so than lately. And that is a thought that I've had recently, that in the fragility of life is the terror of being alive, in a way, and the wonder. It's interesting, this relationship between fear and wonder, and gratefulness and aversion, how this dance between yes and no plays out in such a personal way when dealing with a life-threatening illness such as I am right now. One reason I'm glad to be here is because I look so Buddhist right now. It's either people think I'm a Buddhist or I'm on chemotherapy, and they're both right. I'm certainly not a monk. I haven't taken ordination vows this time. I did about 20 years ago. But this time it's chemotherapy that is causing, or is the cause, the condition for my being without hair on my head. I was diagnosed with cancer 6 months ago, which came as a shock to me, I thought. It was a big surprise. I go grocery shopping at Rainbow Foods. Enough said. You're not supposed to get cancer if you go to Rainbow Foods or Whole Foods if you have more money. But it was an interesting. Yeah, that's an euphemism, that word, interesting. It was a surprise week and day. The weekend before I was diagnosed, I was at Rainbow Foods grocery. In case you don't know, that's a natural foods grocery in San Francisco. And I ran into a friend of mine from a Tibetan Buddhist sangha, who informed me that one of our mutual friends, Ed, had passed away, had died of cancer just before 9/11. And I was very surprised. And and processing it there, right there in, near the corn chips and vitamins. And I also shuddered when she told me personally, because I had just been x-rayed that Friday before, because I had a persistent cough that hadn't gone away for about 2 months. And the last thing I thought of was that it was cancer. I'm not a smoker, never have been, except weed in the 1980s mostly, not so much since then. And the idea that I could be diagnosed with lung cancer just didn't compute when I received the diagnosis in some ways. Especially after hearing about Ed just a few days before. I thought it might be some sort of congestion or pneumonia, maybe TB. Actually, I thought I might have been exposed to TB. But it wasn't. It was lung cancer with a tumor, a fairly good-sized tumor in my upper left lung. And that had already spread to a couple of lymph nodes in my left lung. And so in the next days and weeks, I went through the medical process of getting worked up, which is getting fully diagnosed through CAT scan, MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, and a lot of other laboratory tests and blood work. And all the time, slowly, letting in the reality of this news with support and love, especially of my friend and partner and lover of 26 years sitting right here, Bob Hamilton, who has been... I don't have words to say how important his support has been for me this last 6 months. I'm also very glad to be sitting here together with him today, here. I can't remember when I was sitting there. I could not remember the last time we sat together in a group like this. I really can't. So, again, I thank GBF for that opportunity very much, a group of brothers like this. Needless to say, the past 6 months there have been many, many different thoughts and feelings that have come up with respect to life and death. My previous work, my ongoing work with AIDS, has come into a different focus with my own personal experience. And there's much I could say about the subject of being in this particular situation. I want to share a quote right now from Charlotte Joko Beck, who's a Zen teacher, now living in San Diego. She's a senior student of Maizumi Roshi, and she's written a couple of very good books. One's called Everyday Zen, and the other is Nothing Special, Living Zen. And she's a pretty direct person. She's kind of in-your-face, good teacher. And this past week on the Gay Buddhist Open Forum, which is a listserv, a gay Buddhist listserv in Yahoo, this following passage from Beck Roshi was posted. And she says, intelligent practice always deals with just one thing, the fear at the base of human existence. The fear that I am not. And of course I am not, but the last thing I want to know is that. I am impermanence itself in a rapidly changing human form that appears solid. I fear to see what I am, an ever-changing energy field. I don't want to be that. So good practice is about fear. Fear takes the form of constantly thinking, speculating, analyzing, fantasizing. With all that activity, we create a cloud to keep ourselves safe in make-believe practice. True practice is not safe. It's anything but safe. But we don't like that. So we obsess with our feverish efforts to achieve our version of the personal dream. Such obsessive practice is itself just another cloud between ourselves and reality. The only thing that matters is seeing with an impersonal spotlight, seeing things as they really are. When the personal barrier drops away, why do we have to call it anything? We just live our lives, and when we die, we just die. No problem anywhere. Boy, that's easy to say. It's easy to say. It's not so easy, as we all know, or some of us may know from practicing and attempting to rest beyond our usual grabby self habits. Is this topic's uncomfortable or is causing a bit of angst or bringing up stuff with you, I just invite you just to breathe and let it out. And just be with it. And just to whatever extent you're comfortable being present to it, just be with it. If you're not comfortable being present with it, that's fine too. But just try to be comfortable with being uncomfortable as much as you can. Suzuki Roshi, who many of you have heard of, very famous for being the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, is now out with a sequel, finally. Yay! If there's anything I could do, it could be in the sequel today. And that is called Not Always So. It just came out, edited by Ed Brown, who's the guru of Green's restaurant and cafe, or Chez Panisse, rather, in Berkeley. He's a great chef and a wonderful teacher and writer who's teaches still regularly, I think, in Marin at Green Gulch. And this is a book of Suzuki Roshi's teachings, much like Zen My Beginner's Mind was, that he collected, and has been editing for a long time, and which has finally been issued as a book this last month. I just opened, what I like to do with books like this, since you really can't go wrong with a book like this in terms of reading, is just open it up and see what page I land on. And I landed on this page just before we left to come over here this morning. Suzuki Roshi writes, or says rather, "I think it is good to be excited by seeing a movie. To some extent, you can enjoy the movie because you know that it is a movie. Even though you have no idea of the screen, still your interest is based on an understanding that this is a movie with a screen, and there is a projector or something artificial, so you can enjoy it. That is how we enjoy our life. If you have no idea of the screen or the projector, perhaps you cannot see it as a movie. Zazen practice, or sitting Zen practice, is necessary to know the kind of screen you have and to enjoy your life as you enjoy movies in the theater. You are not afraid of the screen. You do not have any particular feeling for the screen, which is just a white screen. So you are not afraid of your life at all. You enjoy something you are afraid of. You enjoy something you are afraid of." I'll say that again. "You enjoy something you are afraid of. You enjoy something that makes you angry or makes you cry. And you enjoy the crying and anger too, as if you were seeing a movie. If you have no idea of the screen, then you'll even be afraid of enlightenment. What is it? Oh my." And then he laughs. "If someone attains enlightenment, you may ask him about the experience that he had. When you hear about the experience, you may say, 'Oh no, that's not for me.' But it is just a movie, you know, something for you to enjoy. And if you want to enjoy the movie, you should know that it is the combination of film and light and screen, and that the most important thing is the plain white screen." So Suzuki Roshi is very much speaking to the same experience that Beck Roshi was speaking to, the very different, in his own inimitable way. I certainly have had fear to deal with lately, but always in my life, I think. I think it comes with the territory. Many teachers say, in fact, I know it comes with the territory. Many teachers say that with respect to the ego or sense of selfness, that fear and hope are the two closest guardians of the ego with respect to our feeling sense in the world. Those are the two that are maybe the last feelings to go. They are excited by holding on to a sense of ourselves, of myself. I know that in sitting and thinking and feeling after hearing the diagnosis that I received, I could not imagine myself disappearing. I thought about the process of this body and this sense of self that I'm very attached to disappearing. And I could not bootstrap myself into thinking that I was not around. It's impossible for the self to think of itself as gone, really. Who's doing the thinking and who's doing the imagining? In hospice training of various, whether it's Zen hospice or Shanti or any, they often lead us through death personalization exercises where we imagine that we're going through the dying process, which is a very good exercise to go through. Or grief exercises where you imagine, for example, the five things that you are most attached to in life. Yourself, your body, your lover. It can be anything. Your art, your accomplishments. And in one grief exercise, I remember writing down the five things I was most attached to. And one by one, we had to rank them 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And one by one, we had to give up a little sheet of paper and throw it into a purification fire at the end of the room. And that was very hard. It's like I could feel myself and leading the exercise in some cases. You could feel people just literally clutching, holding on to these pieces of paper and not wanting to give them up. And people had the permission not to give them up if they didn't want to. And a couple people didn't. A couple people more or less said, blank you. And said, you ain't taking my piece of paper. You're not getting any of my pieces of paper. In one case, I remember that guy very clearly. He was so honest. I mean, honesty is just refreshing any way it reveals itself. And he was saying, no, not ready. And of course, none of us is in some ways, or very few of us are ready to give up all the pieces of paper. I certainly am not, and not yet. And I certainly wasn't when I heard that diagnosis. The immediate emotional response on December 10th was to cry and to realize, to just take stock and said, okay, I may be entering the bardo of dying in Tibetan Buddhism. The time when you find out that you are beginning to die, losing your body, is distinguished by as a bardo, as a special time or gap or period in one's life to begin practicing in a different way. And I remember praying for people that I loved, and of course, part of me was thinking, how in the heck can I get out of this? It's just natural, and I think I don't think I'm saying anything particularly special or profound here. I think, especially for those of us who have been around, perhaps a lot of death and dying the last 21 years, for example, with AIDS, we've had different experiences coming to terms with this in different ways in our own lives, very really, if we have HIV. Or in the lives of our friends and our community. I've spent a good, most of the last 21 years avoiding getting HIV. And because I was truly terrified by some of the things I saw early on, especially in the epidemic. And so I think when I received this diagnosis of lung cancer, part of me, there's different parts, it sounds like, and there are different voices. Part of me just laughed in a sense of, huh? This isn't compute. How could this be happening? How did this happen? You know, I've been doing my best to survive and to stay alive, which doesn't mean I won't, that I won't survive longer. But the reality is I was diagnosed relatively late in the stages of lung cancer. They didn't catch it early. And in fact, for those of you who don't know much about lung cancer, it's good for you to get a chest x-ray like every 6 months to a year for sure, because they often don't catch it early. They often don't catch it until a symptom starts to manifest, such as coughing in my case. And then by then it may have metastasized or spread, which it has in my case. So, where was I? Did I lose that thought? I guess what I was saying is that the prospect of departing, of losing a body, and a life that I'm identified with, boy, is that fertile ground for practice. Understatement of the day. Zen Suzuki Roshi, in his teachings, as I recall reading, I never met him personally, but I sure read the book a lot, The Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He said, Zen is a matter of life and death. Don't goof off. And I love the goof off. I had to confess that. Like a lot of people at this time, I love entertainment. I love movies. Now I'm trying to pay more attention to my own white screen and just see the core awareness that I have, that we all have, and the seed of Buddha awareness that we all have, that is in fact bigger and clearer and doesn't necessarily, in fact, doesn't disappear with the passing of conditioned phenomena like the body and thoughts and emotions. Okay. Well, I've talked a bit. Are there comments and questions from the group about this light subject? Good news about living with chemotherapy and cancer, which I'm glad to say, and certainly people with AIDS have given me this gift as well, is that we are much bigger. I can tell you that, than a particular disease or a difficult situation, physical situation. I was terrified of chemotherapy before I went into chemotherapy in the beginning of March. In fact, I almost didn't take chemotherapy because I heard it's got a really bad press. Just a second. I can tell you that it's possible to live with chemotherapy as it is possible to live with awareness with cancer. I'm in the 14th week of 18 weeks of it at this point. And sure, there have been some rough times and some changes and difficulties with the body, but that's been really good practice, actually. Easy to say now. Not so easy to say when it's happening. And I don't look forward to more teachings from chemotherapy, but I'll certainly have some. I guess the point that I wanted to make is that who you are, who I am, who we are as human beings with this incredible ability to be aware, just be aware, to give our cows a big pasture to roam. The pasture is another metaphor, like the white screen, for the broadness and openness and spaciousness of mind that we all have. If we practice getting in touch with it, we have that. That is our gift and our birthright as human beings, along with the sorrow and the suffering that comes with it. If I can bring anything to GBF in the next months or year or years, hopefully, could happen. I still hope. Hope and fear are still around my sense of self, and I hope to be around longer. I hope to bring more of this space to share with the group and to also hear from the group about your experiences too and living with the great matter of life and death. So you had a question or comment?
One of the most touching books that I have read was Grace and Grit by Ken Wilber. Did you know it? Have you read it?
Parts of it.
The extent to which it was a fierce teaching, of course, to both of them. Mm-hmm. And it sounds as if your experience is also a teaching for you.
Yeah.
And that you're approaching it in that same kind of way.
Sometimes.
Yeah. It's a very personal matter, of course. You obviously may not be a question you want to even answer, but how has your experience with Bob as a mutual teaching for both of you, do you find that there's a resonance in that condition? And if Bob would make any comment about how it's a teaching for him, too, I would find that very touching.
Okay. All right. You want to think about it a little? Or? You want to speak? I can
make it a little more succinct.
I mean, sorry, I'm paid by the word.
A plant. I knew it.
As a couple who are profoundly in relationship for years, how has Steve's experience of cancer, the possibility of going, affected you and your ideas of life and the possibility of going and his possibility of going and your own possibility of going? So to what extent has it been a learning experience, however fierce a teacher it might be? Is that even better?
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I tend to wander a tick, so. Let me start with my favorite quote. And it'll probably help explain sort of my framework. My favorite quote is, one of my favorite quotes, is from Joseph Conrad, not from Heart of Darkness, but something else that he had said. And it goes something like this, not exactly like this, but something like this. It's, when one grapples with another man's intimate need, do we become aware of how misty and wavering are the beings we share, the warmth of the sun and the light of the stars. That said, it is... profound. And...
let the cheers come. Let the cheers come, please. No. Let her...
there will be tears for a long time. Being human, tears are a good expression of how we're not only connected but attached. I mean, a part of our relationship, without getting into the dirty details, is always having to say goodbye in one way or another. If it's the minor things where a couple, where the other is so involved with the situation, whether it's work or whether it's a particular passion where you feel somewhat left out, or if they go away, you're always saying goodbye. An aspect of being human is you're always saying goodbye in some aspect. It's the physical aspect. The part of me that loves him, whether it is all his patterns, quirkiness.
Quirky?
Quirky. And the particular language we have created just between ourselves. Let's see, where is this going? This is going saying that what I've connected with him, having an aspect of devoted or attachment, learned of who he is, has allowed me to that same compassionate permission to look at how quirky and times in myself that I have not been able to accept. Okay? I'm not saying that I got there yet, but it's given me some space. I mean, the quote that he uses, which used to be a favorite quote of mine when we started out, the one about giving a cow an open pasture, is a
big pasture.
Big pasture. Is a good one. I mean, and just because it is also something that if I can give that to another person, then eventually I'll learn to do that for myself. Because the way I've been raised has been through a lot of, as we all have, through our families, the things that we accepted in life, the way we, how we're supposed to react. If the pattern has been one that has been very hierarchical and dictatorial, then we don't really fully experience life. I mean, therefore I haven't fully experienced who I am, therefore I haven't really experienced that wonder, you know, where that quote sort of touches without putting its finger on that special wonder that's so ethereal and yet is palpable every single moment of my life. When I allow myself the moment of reflection upon that time. It's very reminiscent of the various rituals that whatever we do, you know, whatever it is, rearranging flowers in a house. If it is in Japanese, that the tea ceremony, the point where I'm fully aware of what I'm doing and I've accepted it. So that's not like duty, but I've said I've accepted it, then I'm fully engaged. And then I don't have as much regrets, and therefore I'm also feeling like I got a benefit out of it. That's a hard thing, because there's times in this and with a variety of friends over the years that have had challenges, health challenges or otherwise, that I've hated to respond or felt butting up against, well, I'm not taking care of myself. And that sort of response when I'm like, I'm doing too much for this other person. And then wanting to pull back. There's a bridge of for me that I'm working with that's saying if I choose to do it, and it's very egoistic, I'm working on that. But if I choose to do it, it opens up that sense that I'm doing it for myself as well. And therefore working with other is working for self. Therefore there's not that boundary. It's a lifelong thing on that. I'm going to miss him if he goes before me. And I can assume that he's going to miss me if I go before him. No one ever knows.
That's true. That's a big attachment. And a big one. When we're lying in bed at night and I look at his face, I can't imagine not being there. And it's something that it's a strong attachment. It's very strong. It's been a lot. And he's been through a lot. He's a very patient man. He's given this cow a very, very big pasture over the years. And the quote from Suzuki Roshi is, the best way to control a cow is to give it a big pasture. And that's such a great quote. I mean, that's it's a lot about like this Zen spaciousness and allowing conditioned and personal stuff to come up in the space of awareness and practice. I know Ken and Treya Wilbur. I knew her, she was a warrior, and he's a warrior, in the sense of really wanting to to meet life spiritually. And I met them on a retreat with one of my teachers, Kala Rinpoche, in 1986. And she had cancer then, and she had a real time with it as it progressed. And to some extent, thinking about her scares me, because I saw her and read what she went through. But I also, to some extent, thinking about her inspires me, of course, because as I tried to say before, Treya is bigger, clearly, than some of the challenges that she was faced with. And I recommend that book very strongly if you want to hear a very personal account of a relationship responding to a life-threatening illness. Grace and Grit by Ken Wilber is really, really well done. She's just speechless.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you, Steve, for speaking. And is it Bob? It was very touching, and I think when I'm facing a life-threatening illness of AIDS, and right now I have pancreatitis, and I had my first cocktail that completely got rid of the virus in January. And I was very attached to not having any more problems. And the pancreatitis is a reaction to the meds, so I had to walk the meds, which I like. But the progress of my HIV has been totally unpredictable. In 1994, when I was diagnosed, I called the San Francisco AIDS Center, and I said, "What's the prognosis?" And they said, 5 years. So I switched my mind into this 5-year plan, and I was very attached to dying and to doing service and traveling. That was the 5-year plan. Then the protease inhibitors came along. And it wasn't a joyous thing. It was like, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Because I have to ditch this 5-year plan. And getting your mindset to dying is a very hard thing. And then getting my mindset to living was equally as hard because I had the plan.
Right.
And I really love your noting that our problems are fear-based. I really believe that. I believe a lot of times I'm fearful that I'm not entitled to happiness, that I don't know how to get it, that I'm not worthy, or that I'm too egotistical in wanting to get things. I mean, and accepting that is pretty calming because, oh, here come those fears again, you know, even if I act out on them.
Yes.
You know, by getting tense and stuff like that. And I love the movie metaphor because I was working in television for years, and it really makes sense to me. Oh. And I was visiting my sister last week, and I woke up and I felt my hips. I've lost 20 pounds, and I didn't have it to lose because I've always been skinny. And
I understand that.
I just realized that I had lost a lot of my body. I mean, it wasn't just pounds. I could feel, like right now I have to sit on a cushion because my pelvis is so, my ass is gone. And so I was crying in my pillow, and I wanted to get it all out before I went to see out into the living room and see my sister. And I thought I did, and then I got out there, and I really wanted compassion from her, you know. So I guess I cried and I told her what was going on. She listened and she said, "Gee, that must be very hard." You know, and we had that moment, and then she said, "Now get your laundry into the dryer because we have to leave by 12 o'clock. And it was wonderful. I mean, she really was there for the moment.
That's great.
It was okay. We know that.
Now, we also know, you got to get out of here by noon. Your clothes have just been washed. Get in the dryer. And it was so wonderful. It was like getting me back into reality and not going off in a fog because I was sad and crying, you know, not being attached to that moment.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's just awesome that I was attached to being sad, which is a real big, it's my MO. I really like. There's something very secure about being sad.
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of us are attached to being sad in some ways.
Yeah. But I also, in hindsight, realized in that moment when I was crying, just when you said it, I didn't realize it then, that I was aware that there was space around that. I knew I was crying, but it wasn't despair, you know, as it sometimes can be. And the mood, while I was crying, I did think sort of that I was in a movie. I felt sort of detached and saw myself crying. And I saw this beautiful lake house we were in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is, I just thought of it when you talked, but there was something that sort of saved me from crashing because I kind of saw it as a movie. You know, that's one way of explaining the detachment.
Mm-hmm.
And your talk really helped me. You know, I sometimes feel that there's not a sangha for people who are going through what we're going through.
Hmm.
You know, and I emailed you once, you know, saying, where's the sangha? You know,
mm-hmm.
And I love the ritual you talked about. You know, one thing I don't like about Buddhism is there's very little ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And I like going to Catholic Mass. I was raised Catholic and have the ritual. And I'll just end with the two things I liked about the Mass is that they remember the dead at every Mass.
Hmm.
And it's hard being in this community to see all the losses and not to have a ritual to purge ourselves of the grief. You know, and I love the Mass because if I went every week, I would have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And also, now before the Eucharist, there's the kiss of peace.
Mm-hmm.
And you just hug people near you and shake hands of people you don't know. And this is really, the Sangha is very great. It's really changed since I was a Catholic.
Mm.
I think in the way the liturgy is designed now. So those are just some, you know, spiritual. And I've had a lot of fun. I go to the movies, I go to the theater. And I do have a lot of fun. I don't know whether I'm probably more attached to that than I am to living with HIV.
Mm.
So thanks a lot, Steve. I really appreciate it. Very grateful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Paul. What? Mark was just ahead of you. Steve.
I guess I'll skip to the bottom of what came to mind as you were speaking, actually even in sitting. I was sexually abused as a child, right? And at some point or other, I realized what was going on and was real pissed off about it. And in order to kind of deal with it all, I started using sex, basically, just to kind of get myself through the worst. I remember at one point, I was about 5 or 6 years old, and the guy, I mentioned to him that I told a friend, and he shook me. He said, don't tell me, but you can't tell me, but.
Mm-hmm.
So this relationship that we had, I thought, oh, okay. You know, I realized there was something really very wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at that point, I kind of shut it off, you know, just kind of went, okay, the hell with it. I'm out of here. And then when I realized the implications in my teens, I was just, the rage was so much I couldn't deal. And so I even went further down the road of kind of, you know, doing anything I could. I just kind of said, okay, I'm going to do anything I can to just deal, to just get through this. And
mm-hmm.
so sex became, you know, an option for me.
Mm-hmm.
And my late teens, I realized I was in trouble because AIDS was around and I kind of knew I was taking a lot of chances out there. And so I tried to deal with it. I tried to, you know, 12 steps and did a bunch of stuff. And over the years, I managed to stave off getting HIV until I was about 30.
Okay.
when I got HIV, I was just kind of like, I'm kind of frankly pretty disappointed in how I reacted to that situation. The senses were just like, oh, fuck it. You know, I'm just going to do what I can do to get through this. You know, I said, the hell of the high road. I'm just, you know, going to live it up, and when it hits, it hits. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, of course, there's another side of me that's going, no, this isn't okay. You know, I want to approach this differently. And there are moments of lucidity. You know, there are moments where I can kind of go, okay, you know, I want to... I want at least be present mm-hmm. for the rest of my life. I want to at least, you know, take a minute and maybe actually take responsibility for what's happened. Even though I didn't do it, I didn't start this mess. I have not learned to take responsibility. And uh-huh. It's like, you know, at some point I said, fuck all of y'all. I just said, you know, I'm just not going to do this. Uh-huh. And frankly, I don't know what I've tried everything in the sense that I've tried to approach it and think it through in a way of somehow understanding or getting that sense of that life is fragile and that life is. There's a meaning to it. For me, it's very, I've just slipped into, a lot of the times, just get this over with. I just want to get this over with.
I'm tired of it. I'm tired of thinking about it and feeling it.
Yeah, I'm tired of thinking about it. Just live it, you know. So when I hear someone like yourself speaking, and I saw that movie Wit, too. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
And she's, what's happened to her is through the movies, all of a sudden, her kind of lack of compassion for her students and all these other things, these situations happen to her in the hospital, uh-huh. that it turns it completely around. Like suddenly, she's at the end, when she's incredibly sick, she recognizes
her heart opens
and the situations, what she did, mm-hmm. you know, and I guess for me, there's this sense of urgency. Like, I really would hate it to be where I'm, you know, literally on my deathbed before I can gain that level of recognition. I would uh-huh. really like to be able to find that sooner rather than later. And yet,
you can.
You know, part of me wonders: do I have to be forced?
I don't. Only you can answer that.
Can I actually be? Uh-huh. Is it possible to really be proactive? And that's really don't know.
That's a really good question. I mean, and thank you for being open about where you are, because that's what it's about. I mean, you just did. You just did what you said you'd like to do. You were just very present to where you are, and you shared it and sharing it with the group. And there's no easy answer mm-hmm. to this question. Especially if you're a coyote. I'm a coyote, partly. That's what Bob likes to call me. That coyote energy, which likes to try to, you know, squiggle out of stuff or, you know, it's playful. You know, it just likes to, you know, I think I broke my record for being in a chat room. You know, probably last week. Because there's, you know, some days I'll wake up and I'll just say, I don't want to think profound thoughts, or I don't want to be, you know, a good Buddhist today. You know, those kinds of things. And to some extent, they're sort of little kid or teenage rebellious thoughts, but that's part of me. Yeah. You know, that's part of me that's still alive. And frankly, you know, what's the word? Mindful. All the time. It's kind of a drag, or can be, you know. And there's some days where good fantasy and escapism is, you know, is a good medicine. Yeah, but I can sometimes, you know, it's Brother David once said, he's a Benedictine monk who's been a Zen Buddhist teacher, really great writer. He once said, we go to extremes to find the middle. And so I find that to some extent with my practice, that some days I'll wake up in a mood, or I'll just have not gotten enough sleep, or the chemo is really causing stuff happening. I'll say, I think I'm just going to go where I am today. And I might try to be aware of it some of the time. And other times I just want to get lost and get found again. You know, I'll find myself again later because I'll have these little reminders around the house that will certainly, you know, it's hard to walk about to past all these Buddhas and pictures and that. And, you know, I can only, you know, say, you know, so much. And but the Buddhas, all those Buddhas are me. That's what they basically are. All the iconography and all the symbolism is basically kind of a nice, geometric and colorful and culturally based way, to a great extent, of showing you a mirror. This is who you really are. You have a straight spine. You have two eyes. You have awareness. You can breathe. And you have this ability to be present to your experience. And I'm sitting here as Green Tara or Medicine Buddha or Suzuki Roshi in a picture, just to remind you of that. So I would just ask you to be gentle with yourself. The intention, your awareness already from wit and from seeing, feeling where you are and seeing where she, what happened to her, how her process played out, that's really good. And you can take little small bites. You can do little doses of practice. You can take little morsels to get soften up a little bit. And there's things you can do with Sangha, with people in BAP or other groups, or to start to tenderize yourself a little bit more consciously, rather than waiting for the big kaboom. And it really does, from everything I've read, and I brought an article today, which I can make a copy of for you, it really does help to practice before time, ahead of time. if the whole point of these Buddha's teachings on death and dying and keeping death as an advisor, for example, with Don Juan, and Buddhism certainly does, is that you can train your mind. And mind is a word that's used a lot. You can train your heart to start to open. And you're doing that. I can feel that. You know, to yourself as you are, and to life as it is, and the really, you know, yucky stuff that is part of life. But there's a lot of love in you too, and a lot of awareness and a lot of desire for connection. And so your channel to opening up is already open. It's already happening. It feels like. So go guy. if you want to talk, I'd be glad to talk with you too about wrestling with stuff, if you want to do that. I'm wrestling, and I have times of peace where I'm feeling like, sometimes I'm just too I'm pooped. One of my processes is that I need to get pooped out from all the other stuff before I actually get some clarity. And so sometimes the getting pooped out is really a blessing. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, I know where you're, when you talk about it, about this contemplation of dropping off, so to speak, and becoming nothing. It is difficult. Contemplated that several times in my life, and maybe it's biological or the product of some evil god who makes sure as we stick around we don't want to or something. But, it is a definite horrifying outer darkness type of feeling.
The thought of disappearing.
Well, yeah, disappearing. On the one hand, it seems like, well, you know, if you took some chemicals or something and go to sleep and just not wake up, what's the big deal? And yet, when you think about that, it is a big deal. It seems like a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's just a reaction. The one thing I wanted to talk about, touch on a little bit, is there's almost the assumption here that life is worth living, and to me, that is the issue.
Mm-hmm. It's one issue.
The philosopher said, the answer, so that's the only philosophical question for him. was life is worth living. And I call that the question. I remember even before the movie Network came out, I used to think that it would be great if everybody just at noon on the earth someplace just went out and shook their face at God and said, we're not going to participate anymore.
Call the strike?
Yeah, you just really call the question. I mean, that would be kind of nice to do, actually.
That would sure show him, wouldn't
it? It would sure bring things to a head. If God is a personal type of
or her, sorry.
Energy, or her, or it, or evil demon, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because God could be evil if it's a personal thing. So I don't know. It's like. I mean, because my own experience of life, I mean, call that into question. Period. Mm-hmm. So the idea of disappearance also has the idea of everything disappearing because it's not worth, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. And if it raises the question of disappearing, also raises the question of what disappears.
Yeah.
What doesn't
well,
disappear?
Nothing. So that's the question I had as a child, and we gave it up real quickly because it just produced anxiety.
Right. So it's to me, it's one of those wonder questions. I mean, it's a scary question, but it's like there's a lot of wonder with it. What is that? Well, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. Boy, if there's any question from all this whole process, whether it's asking it about cancer or chemotherapy or life or relationship or just a microphone, what is this? What is this? Can you really say what anything is? Can you? I mean, intellectually? I mean, of course I can call it functionally a microphone, and I can say it's made up of microphone parts, and there's iron in here and all these parts of the earth, certainly in electricity and all these things, but I guess part of me has a difficult time saying what anything really is.
Yeah, that sort of produces the same reaction to me as the contemplation of ceasing to exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, what is this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. Good question.
That's a big one. And we may have to return to that question.
Okay. Steve, next time we will talk about what.
And Bob and Paul and Mark, Harv, thank you for a very rich sharing. And I wish you all a rich life.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.